afternoon, good evening, good metal. My name's Coop. Welcome to the Spoken Metal Show. This is a special treat. No tricks here at the Spoken Metal Show this Halloween, only treats. This was something that we did a long while ago. It seems like maybe over a year ago, we did as part of the Metal on Merseyside project, where we did a live screening of a film. This is the Q&A that preceded it. Why bring it out on Halloween? Well, one, it's Halloween, and we talk about metal's connection with horror. But also, it's finally kind of, I fixed it, found it, fixed all the bits and pieces to it. It was the recording was awful. I had to kind of mess around with it to kind of get where it was. Then lost, then found, then lost again, then listened to it again. I had to kind of figure it out and adjust some bits and pieces of it to make it sound okay. It's still not perfect, but listening back to it, I thought it was fantastic. It's something we want to do again and again, where we sit and talk about metal, and we did a Q&A with this as well. It's a similar thing, I imagine, when we do the thing in February, where we do the radio Q&A and panel and stuff. It's similar like that, where we talk about something and we explore some of the ideas around metal and its connection sociologically and its connection with kind of society. And this was a ton of fun to do, and I'm back now. I'd finally fixed it and got it so it was listenable. I'll let you be the judge. I thought it was really good. I thought it was really fun. And so we're going to have to do it again. We'll maybe screen Demons or Black Roses or something like that. And we'll maybe screen this again and do a little Q&A before or after as well. It was a lot of fun, and it's finally come to light. And it seems like now, Halloween, perfect time to do it. So please enjoy the Metal on Merseyside screening of Trick or Treat. We do the Q&A first, and at the end of this, you'll hear me say, or you heard Ned, I should say, enjoy, and I encourage you to find Trick or Treat. It's on various platforms, and go watch it, because it's a fabulous film as well, but this is a nice companion to it, and it seemed like the Halloween was the perfect time for this to come out. So once again, thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy the show. Good afternoon, good evening, good metal. My name's Coop. I'm from the Spoken Metal Show. Hopefully some of you've listened to it. This is an interesting event, eh? This is something that we promised when we did the Metal on Merseyside project, that we would do other things rather than four bands and £5 on the door. You know, we can do that, and there's some wonderful promoters out there doing it. We wanted to do something else where we would kind of push at the edges of what we would do, talk about things that maybe people weren't talking about, and hold various things. And there's lots of those coming at the beginning of next year, and it's maybe some at the end of this year. But this was the one that we really wanted to do, because there's an enormous connection between metal and horror, as we all know. And we wanted to talk to people about that and talk about that. So we thrashed a few ideas around, and Ned came up with the idea of screening a film, in this case, Trick or Treat. And we thought, well, let's have a conversation. Who can we get? And that brings me very nicely onto the panel. And we're well served this evening. We have, obviously, my good friend Nadeem Hassan, the author of Metal on Merseyside and part of our Metal on Merseyside collective. Do we say collective? Is that what
Project.
We say?
Project, yeah.
Whichever you think sounds the fanciest, we use that. And we kind of cooked up this, and we thought, who could we get? And Ned suggested the fantastic Stella. Stella Marie Gaynor, an author. I want to get this right, because it's a long, very intellectual title, and which immediately puts me out of it. Is it of the author of the Rethinking Horror in the New Economics of Television? Wow! So, what we should do? I should go name. Let's play it like a gig. Like, I should be like, what the fuck up this room? This is like the academic equivalent of that Denny's, isn't it? This is it, isn't it? And we all smash shit up. So, ladies and gentlemen, Nadeem Hassan. You can show some love for him. The people will be listening to show there. Beautiful. And a fantastic Stella Marie Gaynor. So the way this is going to play out is we've got a few sort of bullet points that we want to cover, we think need talking about. Then we're going to open it up to the floor for a little bit of a Q&A. And then we're going to screen the film. And that's kind of how we're going to do it. And we'll see how that works. We're probably going to do a few more of these screens, I feel. We're probably going to do some more. And maybe even get some nice guests. I did try and get the director of this. Keeps cutting out. I'm far too loud a voice to be putting up with this. I will, as Jack Black says, master blaster that. So I contacted the director, the wonderful Charles Martin Smith, who you may know from as Oscar Wallace in The Untouchables, but he directed this wonderful picture. And he said nothing, because it was very difficult for me to get anything past his gatekeeping people that's all around him now, because he's very famous and very important. But I think going forward, we'll definitely get some more guests and maybe some special things. But we are well served today with Stella here. I'm going to hand over to most of the guys now as we ask some questions, I suppose. Let's start at the obvious starting points. What's the first time you guys connect metal and horror? When's that happened for you?
Shall I go? It was when I was a teenager, which was a long time ago, and I was a metal fan then and a metal fan now. And when I started my early forays into horror film, and it was back in the days where we'd go to the local Blockbuster and rent VHSs, and one of the films that we did watch, we used to do these all-night movie marathons, and we'd stay up all Friday night and watch horror films. And one of the films that we got out on VHS was this one. And I remember thinking at the time, oh, of course, metal and horror fit together, because all the iconography is the same, lots of themes are similar, the transgression of boundaries is the same. And I put the connection together then, when I was 16, and then I'll be honest, I don't really think I've come back to it that much, because I've concentrated very much on horror as my job and to be scholarship. And now to think about them together again is really fascinating, which brings me around to last night on Ned's suggestion, I watched Deathgasm. And now I'm back in horror and metal together all the way.
How about you, Ned?
For me, it was probably the video for Dream Warriors by a band called Dokken. So I'm of an age where I remember watching a late night show on ITV called The Power Hour, which became something called Raw Power. And I saw a video by this band Dokken, and I'm a bit of a hard rock fan, and they released a song called Dream Warriors, which featured in the film Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors. And it's one of the first songs that was commissioned for a horror film. So in previous horror films, apart from Friday the 13th Part 6, which also has a song commissioned for it called He's Back by Alice Cooper, and apart from what you're going to watch later, Fastway were commissioned to do the soundtrack for Trick or Treat. Prior to that time, if any heavy metal songs were in a film, it was just pre-existing songs. So Dream Warriors is one of the first songs commissioned for a horror movie. It fascinated me, you know, because here I was as a teenager just getting into this world of heavy rock and metal, and along comes something which encapsulates my passion in my teenage years, you know, horror movies and heavy metal. So I was hooked, you know, that kind of got me into the band Dokken a bit as well after that. So that was my introduction.
I think, like, is the film Maximum Overdrive, is that horror? Can we say, is that horror? Or is it sci-fi? What are we saying? If we can get a vote from the room, let's see a show of hands, great podcasting, show of hands for, is it a horror? Maximum Overdrive, anybody seen it? Got a couple there. Or is it sci-fi? This guy's here ready for a fight, like, damn right it is. So that was the first, because of the opening scene of that, Stephen King, and it's one of his, like, you know, I think it's a directorial debut, and he's at the cash machine, he presses the buttons, it's all about machines running rampage, and the machine tells him to go fuck himself. And says, you were an asshole, sorry. And he turns and he puts his glasses up and he turns to his wife and goes, this machine just called me an asshole. And you hear the absolute magnificence that is AC/DC come in for Who Made Who. And the whole film is peppered with a whole discography of AC/DC stuff all the way through it. There's a van that gets hit by another car that's got AC/DC on the sign. There's loads of nods to old AC/DC songs where he's like, he says Hell's Bells and things like that. And I remember hearing that and I'm thinking, who are they? You know, that sounds like that's the music of rebellion. That's the music of, like, if that's what Stephen King, who's obviously the master of horror, has put together, it must be something I get into. And it's like when you listen to any form of music, you're like, I'd like to hear more. I'm going to follow this down the rabbit hole. It's the same with metal and horror for me, just with two trains running alongside each other. It's like, okay, I really like that, but that doesn't seem very extreme, so let's go to more extreme metal. So we go to Maiden, and you go to all that, and you're all the way over, and before long you're in Cannibal Corpse, and you're way over here. But to say with horror, and then I just went all the way down, and you go through your Hellraisers, and then you go through to all the kind of your Faces of Death and Guinea Pig and all that type. So you get all the way down there, and they're all just two trains running, and I've never wanted to get off. but yeah, that was my first introduction. Which came first? Was that, like, were you both into metal or into horror first? Was the one that came first? Because mine were very similar sides.
I think it's happening at the same time. So we were talking before about when, you know, sort of early years of getting into either metal or horror. And for me, it was, I shared a bedroom with my older sister, so she got me into metal. So she was a goth. I'd started on an early diet of Sisters of Mercy, and so I was that, but then my mum was a big horror fan, so she was making me watch The Omen and Carrie and stuff when I was far too young. It was right there in my childhood and in my house. It's in, you know, music in the bedroom upstairs with my sister, and downstairs on the telly with my mum. So it was just always together. And as I grew up and I started going out to Jilly's Rock World, far too young, but doing that anyway, and, you know, all the lovely boys that I met in there, they were all wearing either metal band t-shirts or horror t-shirts. It was just, the culture was one and the same, and I found that all the metal fans that I was meeting and starting to get to know, they all had a wall of VHSs at home as well. So it was just always connected.
Why is it then? What I mean, I suppose the biggest one of questions we'll ask this evening is, why do they make such good bedfellows? Why is the elements of metal and all the things that go with it, and the elements of horror, why do they make such good bedfellows?
I was thinking about this question beforehand, and I think there are several dimensions to it, really, you could talk about. One's from a kind of experiential point of view, one's more from a historical perspective, and one's to do with the controversy that we'll talk about in a while. From an experiential perspective, sorry, let's get my tongue right. From an experiential perspective, if you think about the experience of going to a horror film, so lots of horror scholars talk about horror in experiential terms. It's like a thrill ride. It's like going on a roller coaster. So you go to the cinema and you go for an experience, you know, thrills and spills, jump scares and so on. And I think there's some parallels with metal, because if you think about what metal does, it takes you on a bit of a journey. It's got that kind of the power to it. It's got that, for me anyway, it's got that kind of affective dimension. It moves you. Mm-hmm. And I think so from that sense, the feelings are similar. And I also think that this isn't always the case, but it certainly was the case for a lot of people I knew. Both horror and metal are kind of like a rite of passage for people. So horror, you know, when you're a teenager, you kind of dare your friends, oh, have you seen this? Because you kind of want something that frightens you, that kind of takes you out of your comfort zone. And I think with metal as well, lots of people get into metal in their teenage years because it's a bit rebellious, because maybe it's something that their mum and dad don't like very much. It's louder than a lot of other music. And there's that kind of, I think that experiential thing is definitely important, and there's parallels there between both of them. In terms of history, what's interesting about horror and interesting about metal is they have a similar historical trajectory. They enjoy their sort of peak commercial success in roughly a similar period. So you could say the horror boom sort of starts with films like The Exorcist in the late 1970s and so on. You've got metal really flourishing with new wave of heavy metal in that period of time. And then you get the whole slasher boom with horror and so on that goes into the 1980s. And as we'll talk about in a bit, you also get a period of controversy and moral panic relating to both horror and metal as we go into the 80s. But yeah.
The themes that they both explore as well are, echo each other. So in horror is a site to explore fears and anxiety and social cultural problems, and metal has frequently, and will continue to do so, I hope, been also a response to things that people are worried about, that are afraid of. You know, we all remember screaming along to Rage Against the Machine when we were 15, and, you know, maybe screaming it to your parents downstairs when they couldn't quite hear you. But that same angst about what's going on in the world and tackling it through an art form occurs in both genres, both mediums, I think.
It's interesting, we talk about like when this first began and our first kind of times that we see these movies and this music together. I suppose maybe 70s, you're looking at, I mean, Sabbath took it from, obviously, from the film Black Sabbath. And, you know, and the, for the same reasons that you're saying, it was, you know, Iommi and Butler talk about how it's like, well, you know, isn't it weird that people go to see a movie to be scared? Why don't we make music for people to be scared of? And then all of a sudden we create heavy metal. And so it's interesting that, and then you talk about, like, I mean, that's not necessarily the 70s, but you move into the 70s and stuff. And, yeah, I mean, I remember when I was doing some research for this, I was looking at like Iron Maiden, when they did Bring Your Daughter to the Slaughter, they were using old 60s and stuff, and black and white horror as well. So it's only really, I agree it's cyclical. I think that it got to the 80s when they fully met up. I think if they flirted for a long while, and then the 80s is when they got together and had the baby, you know, it's like the 80s was when it kind of went crazy for both metal and horror. I think both of them were like, we know we're on the edge of things, let's lean fully in. And I think metal's cyclic like that, like horror, same as the 90s and then the 2000s, and where we are now, where you have remasters and re-releases and reimaginings of albums and music and metal as well as the films. It seems to be because I think maybe we metal tends to share the same enemies as horror, and it's often because it's seen as the kind of ills of society. I think it's, I thought it was interesting what you're saying about it being a rite of passage. Yeah, I didn't get onto that immediately. That, you know, you would say to your mate, have you heard this album? This is fucking incredibly heavy. Or you would go, look at this fucking beheading in The Omen. It's fucking boss, you know. Like, when I was a kid, The Thing, I saw The Thing when I was a kid, and it's like, fucking, I went to see the remaster of it a few days ago, and it's still terrifying. It's an amazing piece of work. You know, Rob Bottin's effects are amazing. But that was like, that was passed around the schoolyard, you know, DVD, not DVDs at my age, it was VHSs. It was like a slate written on the set. It was VHS, but it was passed around, like, look at this. Now, I don't think you get that with music other than heavy metal. I don't think someone's passing around a copy of a pop record. I don't think that happens. I don't think someone goes, listen to this, it's fucking the most important thing in the world. I don't think that happens. I didn't see that as a rite of passage till you mentioned that and realised that that's exactly what we did. So when we get to the 80s, and this is when metal and horror kind of really blow up, and the problem with that is that the more popularised you become and the more kind of, you know, intense, as we've said, and extreme you go in both ways, the more you court controversy. And, you know, when the 80s was full of that, I'm thinking, you know, the PMRC and the trials for that, like, and it was the Filthy 15. And then you have like I'll try and make parallels as you go with this to show that they all run alongside each other. Then you get the Video Nasties and the censorship laws and things like that, which happened with sort of horror. And then you go, I mean, all the way through to like Satanic Panic and this kind of like seeing that not only is it a bad thing, but it's also the ruination of our youth and children. It's like, why is it always metal and why is it always horror? The fuck is, someone else can take the blame, you know. Video games, I think they kind of entered it later on, like, yeah, they came later. But they've always served as a social pariah, haven't they? So it's like a really...
scapegoats.
Why is that? Why? Come on, Stella. We brought you on the spot.
Well, why is it always horror? Why is it always metal? If you can take it back to why those two things make such good bedfellows in the first place, one of the things we can look at is the iconography of both of those things. Mm. All the dark stuff, all the gothic stuff, upside down crosses and pentagrams and all those kinds of things. And we can take that right back to Salem and people, women, being persecuted for doing nothing. But that same fear of anything that questions or challenges conservative and Christian status quo, and that's all that happened again in the 1980s with dickheads like Mike Warnke. Have you come across this guy? Mike Warnke, check him out. You will throw your laptop out the window. He was he's a con man, essentially, but he was turned into like this Christian comedian, if it can be such a thing, and he recorded these albums where he did these terrible jokes, but woven into it were these monologues about Satanism and children doing satanic rituals and satanic abuse, and he claimed that he was part of a Satanist cult and that he'd been raping and murdering and eating babies, and it was all bollocks, but he turned that into a career, and he was one of the kickstarters for Satanic Panic. And he was on, what's it called, the Geraldo, was
Geraldo,
it?
Geraldo, yeah,
big,
yeah.
American talk shows. He was on there. He's still got a YouTube channel. You know, and he was directly responsible for the big sort of media blanket coverage of metal and horror is all intertwined with these satanic rituals, which then has the real world implications into people, poor kids like the West Memphis Three.
Yeah, it's like, isn't it the book Michelle Remembers as well?
Yes.
Kind of talking about how, you know, that these are what's going on behind closed doors, mm-hmm. all fantasy. And it's only when you, I think one of the good things is, though, is it can sometimes show up how ridiculous arguments are when they're placed against them. You know, like, take that for example, you know, that's the everybody's devil worshipping that listens to metal and stuff like that. And, you know, we'll get into Reverse Records and play into that in a moment. But look at something as ridiculous as the PMRC, where you go, you know, there's hidden messages in metal and all this, that type of thing. And it takes, like, the unlikely combo of Zappa and Dee Snider, which is like this, the best thing in the world to me. And they speak eloquently on this and say, look, this isn't what's causing the problems, mm-hmm. and show them up for the complete misunderstanding of what they think a genre is. Mm-hmm. You know, and they look very, very foolish. And then, but even with just that as an example, you know, you think about what happened to Judas Priest, you know, and it, like, you know, you only have to see where Glenn Tipton's talking about how, you know, there's a guy sitting like just there, and he's like, how many more kids will this record kill? And you're like, that's just not how this works. And it just shows it up, the kind of madness that pervades it. But I think we're it's almost an easy target, isn't it? Because it's seen as being dumb and base level stuff, isn't it? Blood and guts and you know, thrash metal and all that. It's simple music to these people that kind of want to, in, for want of a better word, demonise it.
Can I
feel free?
I mean, I think, you know, what we've got here, I think, is something quite complex, actually. Mm. And that you know, what happens a lot of the time when societies have periods of change that are difficult to understand, then we have scapegoating, you know, and social change. So the reasoning behind some of this is quite complex. I think if you look at American society in the 1980s, what was happening is that you had a rise in divorce rates that have been happening since the 1970s, so rise in single-parent families. You had the kind of anxieties about so-called latchkey kids, you know, so kids kind of fending for themselves a lot of the time because mum or dad is working. Complex social problems, okay? And this is a period of Reaganomics when ordinary communities are having lots of money taken away from them and the rich get richer, the poor get poorer, right? We know all that sort of stuff. So rather than tackle the complex social problems head on, what often happens is other things get scapegoated. And I think in this case, heavy metal, Dungeons and Dragons, MTV... Yeah. Satanic Panic, all of that stuff was happening in a way because it's easier. It's easier to distract people from what's actually kind of happening. But, you know, if we just kind of backtrack a little bit, so just for the sake of the audience, so The parallels between horror and metal can be made on the level of, in America, there was a pressure group called Parents Music Resource Center, PMRC, and they were a high-profile pressure group. And basically what they did, as Coop mentioned, they drew up a list called the Filthy 15. So these were rock and pop albums, actually, that they deemed to be, their words, porn rock. Okay? So on the surface, it's very easy to laugh at that. But what's quite interesting, I think, is some of the scholarship more recently has revisited what the PMRC were trying to do and actually kind of said, well, not everything that they were trying to do was wrong. So what they were concerned about at the time were things like misogyny in music lyrics. And they were asking questions about misogyny. Now, there are scholars like Rosemary Lucy Hill and Heather Sauvigny who've revisited what the PMRC have said. And said, actually, not everything they said was wrong. There's nothing wrong with calling out bands like Motley Crue or Wasp and saying, are their lyrics misogynist? But what ended up happening was it turned into a debate which was just about censorship, which was just kind of saying, so it became about free speech versus censorship. And the bigger point was, and we might come on to this in a moment, these moral panics, just as in the UK with the Video Nasties moral panic, where they drew up a list of banned films, 72 films Department of Public Prosecution had on their list. These moral panics had real impacts on real young people. And that's the issue, really, that, you know, what starts to happen is, if you're a kid who's having a hard time at home, your parents, if you live in LA and you're listening to heavy metal music as an outlet, your parents can ring up and have you institutionalized, because there are certain institutions who, if your kid was listening to metal, they would consider institutionalizing that kid. If you were involved with probation services, if you'd been in trouble with the law, you could be subject to something called demetalling, where they would actually take away your albums, t-shirts, etc., and stop you.
I'm sorry I laughed at that. But it's crazy. I've never heard that phrase. Demetalling. I have a vision of some young 15-year-old kid being dragged out of his house with, like, in his records.
Absolutely.
And stuff.
Those things happened. So, you know, as good as some of the intentions were, they had really profound consequences.
Just thinking over my dead body.
Yeah.
Not my Metallica album.
You've got?
No.
Not
my original vinyl.
Yeah. It's signed. Wow. Yeah. But metal has that wonderful thing. It's like, because we're a chameleon, aren't we? And so is horror. It changes as it needs to stay alive, mm-hmm. and keep moving. It's like, so we have that wonderful thing. So they go, okay, let's figure this out. What we're going to do is we're going to put on a record, we're going to put parental advisory, explicit lyrics, and the entire metal community laughs their ass off and goes, brilliant, now I know which records I need to buy. And it's like, you know, we've always had that kind of thing where we survive, we pass through, we change. How many times have you heard that metal's dead and heavy metal's old school and all that type of thing? Which leads us, you know, as we're moving through the times very sort of poorly here, but to like the 90s, and then there was a little, in order to survive, I think sort of horror films did this as well, and still do to a little bit, there was an injection of politics as well. You know, we got that kind of like, okay, well, we're going to be attacked, we have to kind of be ready on all fronts. You take someone like, you know, we have to mention Marilyn Manson at this stage, because mm-hmm. of the imagery was pure horror imagery. You know, Manson, you know, it's, you know, you have to look at that to see what it is. But there's little elements of politics as well. And I imagine that that's basically almost like a reactionary thing, that, you know, we're going to get attacked, so you might as well, you know, you might as well cover every base and make sure you... His character of Manson is, you know, an amalgamation of all kinds of things, and horror is very much in it. He cites Alice Cooper, you know, as being part of that. And they, although Alice Cooper was maybe more vaudeville, he's still kind of taking elements of that. And then when seeing it's like the 90s and 2000, and you can see the change in horror as well, you know. And so we get this really weird situation where you can see it cyclically, and I think it's pretty much every 10 years that you kind of see a new version of it is. And I mean, I don't want to jump too far, but I do want to open up some questions at some point. But it kind of leads us to Stranger Things, right? Mm-hmm. It's so where you get a new generation who maybe even haven't even heard heavy metal suddenly seeing a character like in that they think, okay, well, what's this guy's deal? You know, it's like, what's this music? What's this song? And it kind of, we go again. You know, it's like, okay, well, that's what's going to be remembered maybe for this 10 years. It's going to be Stranger Things and Eddie. And is that a good thing then? Surely that's a positive thing. It's another way of us, horror and metal, shedding its skin again and moving to the next version of that. Is it? Or maybe, I don't know.
I think as a broad answer, it is a good thing, because if Eddie's character on Stranger Things gets some kids or adults, anyone really, grandparents, into metal and it brings them in, then, you know, the more the merrier, I feel. But it does possibly start to throw up questions around stereotyping. And
is Eddie a stereotype?
Maybe. I don't know.
Did that start with things like Guitar Hero, where there was like, caricatures of various music genres there, and the metal guy, was very similar, like all a better beefed up version of Eddie. I suppose you've got to have some point to start. Yeah. You've got to have a starting point.
It's a shortcut
point
to meaning, people, you know, understand it.
I think it's significant that Stranger Things is set in the 1980s, mm-hmm. because Eddie Munson is your stereotypical... What I think they still use this term in American high schools. He's a burnout. Mm-hmm. It's what they call a burnout. Mm-hmm. So basically, famous study was done by a female scholar called Penelope Eckert, and it's called Jocks and Burnouts. So jocks in America are kind of like, if you like, they kind of represent conformity, jocks. So they get involved with societies, they... are very active in sports. A burnout is a kind of someone who's alienated from that. So you get, say, and we see this character in lots of popular cultural texts. So think about what's the film called? The Breakfast Club, famous John Hughes film. That guy, the main guy, I can't remember the name of the actor who plays him, but the main guy,
Judd Nelson,
he's a burnout, really. He's kind of a disaffected kid. Yeah. When we watch Trick or Treat in a minute, you know, the Eddie in Trick or Treat, he's a burnout. In the sense that he's alienated from the rest of the kids in school to a large extent, to a far greater extent than Eddie Munson is. Because Eddie Munson in Stranger Things, you know, he at least has a support network with the Hellfire Club. You know, for those of you who haven't seen Stranger Things, the Hellfire Club is, they have a Dungeons and Dragons. So they're playing Dungeons and Dragons, and they have a Dungeons and Dragons society in their school. So Eddie's kind of the head of that. So he's kind of connected. He's well respected in the school. Whereas actually, the representation of the burnout in Eddie Weinbauer in Trick or Treat is a lot different, because he's far more of a loner, and actually he's kind of going through quite a lot of stuff, and he's having suicidal thoughts, and he's a more of a kind of loner character in many respects. So I think that Eddie Munson represents that kind of burnout stereotype, really. That kind of anti-establishment opposite to the jock that we see in a range of shows. I like Eddie Munson. If anyone's seen the show, I think he's a good character. My one kind of concern with Eddie, I don't know if any of you saw this, James Hetfield from Metallica.
This Halloween.
He dressed as Eddie for Halloween. Yeah. And I kind of thought to myself, what does that say? And I was kind of thinking, well, what that kind of says to me is that metal fandom or a certain kind of metal fan almost becomes a kind of caricature, like a kind of mask that people put on, you know, and it's exotic and it's just... Whereas actually, we know that metal fandom is not like that. It's a lifestyle. It's a subculture. It's something that people are involved with. So I think the problem I have with that is that it sort of trivializes fandom, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But that's my only concern. I do like Eddie. I like the fact that kids are getting into Eddie. I like the fact that kids will check out those bands that are on Eddie's battle jacket. If more kids listening to Wasp and Dio,
he's given a heroic arc.
Yeah,
and that's probably something that we ain't seen. You know, certainly interesting. Where people are often the guy that dies in a movie. You know what I mean? Because he's got no future, or she's got no future, or they're seen as kind of an entry point for drugs in a movie, or if they want someone to steal a car. And say, look, every bad guy is always like the leather jacket. You know what I mean? And the skull on a t-shirt and stuff like that. That's the token bad guy. You know, but Eddie's given a very heroic arc, you know. Absolutely. So that's a sign, I think, that now we understand that there are stereotypes, and I understand there's millions of stereotypes, and you could say every single genre has its couple of stereotypes within it, but they're just starting points. You know, it's like when someone young is first getting into metal, they will look for what they think is right. And then eventually, you know, we've all done it. You start with one style of your favourite guitarist or singer, and you slowly bring in other things. And you know, you might like Stevie Nicks if you're a girl, so you put on loads of, like, you know, fabrics. And you might like Elvis if you're a guy, so you're changing. That's what happened, Lemmy. So it's like, you kind of amalgamate it. That's like the first time you write a song, you know, you try to aim it to be like your favourite artist. That's not stereotyping. It's just going, okay, I want to get it close to being what I think a metal song is. And then eventually it moves on. I think now we're a bit more welcoming, aren't we, to say, you know, okay, you know, that's cool. But it's, I mean, what does it come down to? It comes down to that the old meme of the guy asking the young girl name three songs by the band. That's the bad element to that. Mm-hmm. But I think that girl's bought that t-shirt, so I'm happy with that. Mm-hmm. You know, that's cool. It's interesting, isn't it, Stella? It's an interesting. I don't know. Are we moved forward in acceptance and in there? But is that necessarily a good thing? Because we've always fought the law. Why is it good then? If we kind of go, oh, well, no, it's okay. No, you can wear. You can wear your earring to work. What? You can have long hair. What? You can have tattoos in the workplace now. What? Shit, what am I rebelling against now? I've lost all my... Hold on. I can't think of anything now. So you can't... Because it's all been kind of... I don't know, is that gentrification? I don't know. That's a strange one to answer. That we didn't promise we were going to answer a whole bunch of questions tonight. By the way, we were going to raise probably way more than we did.
Being asked to name a song when I've been wearing a metal t-shirt has happened to me though, and it was when I went to get a COVID vaccination, and I was wearing a Gojira t-shirt, and I sat down. I could see the guy had seen it, and I sat down, and before he gave me my vaccine, I had to name a song. I was like, I want the vaccine.
Wow, I would have stabbed him with the needle. Fuck, that is horrifying.
It's one of those things where you don't realise after the event. It's like,
what is the expected outcome of that conversation? Let's just for a second.
It's a thought experiment.
So say he's trying to he finds you attractive, so he's trying to find a come on in some way to take you home that evening or on a date. Let's say that's what it is. That's a fucking really shitty fucking way over. What's the expected thing? You know, that you do name some. Okay, so you're okay. You've passed the test.
I get my vaccine.
Yeah, you get your vaccine, or you don't, and that you've now been weaned out of that.
Back on.
I don't understand. I just don't understand the game plan. It's like a really shit game plan.
I don't know. I didn't understand.
Do you know what that kind of the last sort of thing before we get to Q&A is that. With the horrible words of gatekeeping and elitism. Now, bringing it in back to horror, recently, the thing that you had with Hellraiser, so they are, as most, I imagine, will know, that they rebooted or reimagined Hellraiser, and it caused a whole bunch of controversy because there was the old-school Hellraiser fans were like, it can't be a woman portraying Pinhead, it can't be this, it can't be that, it doesn't reflect this, it doesn't reflect that. And there was a lot of... It happens every time there's a remastered, same with like Halloween or anything like that. Whenever they kind of bring something back or they change it, there's a lot of people who say, oh, they've only changed it to make it politically correct, or, you know, that type of thing. I mean, what's our thoughts on that? Like, is the, you know, elitism and gatekeeping in both horror and metal? It exists? I think so.
I mean, I think it exists. Without a doubt. I mean, we were talking before, weren't we, about, you know, when you're on social media, it's all, a lot of the time it's all about, you know, displays of knowledge, you know, people listing this and that and the other, and do you know this? You know, you can't just say, oh, I like something anymore. You've got to kind of know chapter and verse in it. I mean, I kind of have sympathy with people who are kind of gatekeeping to a point, only in the sense that, if you look at metal's history, metal has been, and metal fans have been what Dina Weinstein calls proud pariahs. So in the past, metal was never given any legitimacy, never given any radio airplay, especially in the US and over here as well, absolutely the same. So the fans and the artists developed a very strong bond by the fans supporting them and going to see the tour. So there was that very kind of intimate and strong bond between the artist and the fan. So I think, you know, given that evolution, I can understand some of the sort of gatekeeping, because it's kind of like, well, you know, I liked this for a long time and this was my entry point into it, and at the time I had to really fight to kind of get this stuff recognised as anything other than garbage by critics and so on and so forth. So I get it from that perspective. But then when it comes down to kind of, oh, we're too sniffy and we don't like them selling T-shirts in bloody, you know, Primark. Or, you know, I don't want kids to be getting into metal after watching Stranger Things. That's, you know, I think that's nonsense now, because everyone has their access points to this music. For me, bloody hell, it was watching the Top of the Pops that got me into metal. I mean, you can't get more mainstream than that. You know, that was our first band I saw on Top of the Pops, that was Whitesnake. You know, I was like, wow, Whitesnake. And that got me into hard rock and metal. So I'm not about to be kind of elitist or sniffy about it, but I kind of get it in a funny kind of way. I kind of get it, because I think metal fans have kind of been almost socialized to be that little bit defensive about their culture in a way. So I kind of get it from that perspective.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I agree. There's a lot sort of people trying to build and develop their subcultural capital to, you know, to be the ones that know the most, and to be the most in the know, and sort of boundary patrolling what's let in and what's not. And there's a lot of that with horror as well. You know, you mentioned remakes, and that generally gets people kicking off. If a studio mentions that they might be thinking about possibly considering maybe doing a remake, then people start booting off before it's been done. And it's like, well, it's just part of genre development, and it pushes cycles forward and it moves the genre forward. And it's, you know, you get a lot of first big time filmmakers, that's their first break, is making a remake. And, you know, it does serve a purpose. It can be commercially motivated, but then so is making anything, because if it's going to be a job, it needs to make some money. If it has an inbuilt audience, then fantastic. But it's, you know, I do find the boundary patrolling a little bit off putting and a little bit, a bit patriarchal at times.
I've not heard that phrase before, boundary patrolling.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
Just deciding what to let in and what's not. That's not horror enough, that's not metal enough, it's not hard enough.
Yeah.
Well, I like it.
And it's almost like a race to kind of, you know, be heavier than the other person, or see a film that contains more blood and gore than another person. It's like,
it's that posturing that you did when you were at school with, have you seen this? Have you listened to that? And it carries on into adulthood, and I think, you know, grow up.
Yeah, it's one of those, I think it's, I suppose gatekeeping, I'm happy there's a gate. I'm happy there's a gate that's open that someone can get through, mm-hmm. and you know, let's move away and let that person come. It comes from two places, isn't it? Like, it's the one place is fear. If you're someone who's into a band and it's an underground band, and suddenly they become famous, and it costs more to see them live, and they have to produce more records, so the quality tends to wane. I get that, I understand that, and there are examples of that. But you know, truly good artists will go through that. You know, think of someone like System of a Down. Like, still as quirky as they were, you know, you could argue albums are better, but they retained the thing, you know, Maiden pretty much the same way. And, you know, so I can understand how it kind of affects it. But there's the other school of thought as well, is that, like, especially with horror, you see this a lot where you talk to someone and they go, oh my God, you've never seen.
Yeah.
And that's, I love that. There's nothing better. Like, I saw Barbarian and then immediately wanted to watch it with the missus and watch her reactions to it. I was like, you have to see this, and like, start sitting, watch the movie. And I think that's great, because then that gets the word out better. And we talk about, we use the word culture numerous times there, and that's what it is. In order to move forward for both, it needs to shed its skin and all the bad things that go with it, the misogyny and stuff, and the bad things that happen, and the stereotypes and that type of thing. And as we move forward, reinvent and re-explore. I mean, both metal and horror surely are mirrors of society. We just have to make sure that we keep that mirror clean, for a terrible cliche to end on. Let's throw it out to everybody else, so we can get. I'm going to try really poorly to see if this works.
One, two.
Okay. So I'll be helped by my willing assistant here. If anybody wants to ask any questions, we'll try and field them. Now, you want to pass the mic around. Ask any question you want about what we think about metal or horror in any way at all. Feel free. In the meantime, we'll talk about Alfred. Why you? Better put your hand up or something, or we'll pass it round. Don't be shy. Metal and horror, best soundtracks. Go, Ned.
Okay.
You can't have Dokken again, because you're fucking selling Dokken.
Can I have three?
Yeah, you can have three.
Yeah, okay. So I think overall, Deathgasm is the best one.
Yeah.
without a doubt. I think, you know, Skullfist with Ishan and Midnight and all the rest of that, that's a killer soundtrack. Probably overall that's best. Total cheese fest one, the cheesiest one ever, which is full of Z-list hair metal, is a film called Nightmare Beach.
Oh yeah.
Which is a slasher movie by an Italian director called Umberto Lenzi. Check that out, it's terrible. It's absolutely...
Check that, it's terrible. It's terrible, and therefore amazing.
It's brilliant, and a sort of underrated one, I would say, 1985's Demons.
Fantastic. Top shot, Dario Argento.
Great use of access, accepts Fast as a Shark.
Fast as a Shark,
yeah.
Quick question, Lee. It's not.
I just fucking throw that thing, like, yeah, we'll just power
just
it.
Just shout, lead it back sucks. Into that. Did Italian films of the 70s and 80s Virgo influence Western, you know, I'm Wesley Western, I mean, English speaking culture of metal horror, like, as you just said, Demons?
100%
it did. Earlier ones, like soundtracks by Goblin and,
yeah.
Red.
Completely Suspiria, Ed Tenebrae, and stuff. There are a million European and UK bands named after Dario Argento films and Roberto Bravo. There are a million, and God bless all of them. Goblin recently toured in Europe, and they're an exception. They're still going, and they play stuff from Dawn of the Dead. And they do stuff. And Zombie. It's a different, slightly different lineup, but it's still there. And there's 100%. Like, if you watch Demons, it's full of metal, because they know how cool it is. Like, they want a scene, Fast as a Shark, the scene in Demons with Fast as a Shark is where he goes on a bike, straps a samurai sword to the front of the bike, and starts riding through all the demons, and it's like Fast as a Shark, and who knows, like, it's given. I'm like, there's no other song that could be used there.
It's
100%, and it's what happened. What was really great is that when bands were touring in the early 80s and 90s, what better way to get a copy of a VHS thing, like, you know, like Cat of Nine Tails or anything, your Bird with a Crystal Plumage, if we want to talk about Argento. It's like, that was a great way of doing it. So you would go over to these European places and pick up these things, and most of the time it would be in Italian, it would be dubbed, it would be DVDs. And there was a whole sort of, tour buses were like a real haven for horror. You'd open like these things and there'd be pornography and horror. And it was a great way of seeing a lot of pornography, and it was a great way of seeing a lot of horror. But yeah, 100%. you go to a lot of metal venues, like, you know, in especially in Germany, and it is festooned with early 70s horror and early 70s metal. 100%. 100%.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's difficult to know whether it influenced them. I think that what's interesting about the mid-80s period is we certainly get the commercialization happening. You know, I think before then, like you say, those films might have used metal to an extent. But I think what started to happen as we get to the sort of mid to late 80s is you get these major corporations starting to recognise, if we put a killer soundtrack together, we'll attract horror fans.
Heavy and bloody works.
Films like Shocker, for instance.
Yeah, Megadeth.
You know, the soundtracks were often much better than the movie.
Well, they made them. They made money on the soundtracks, didn't they? That was the thing.
Absolutely.
Like, you would.
Well, this film that we're going to watch in a moment, Fastway's Trick or Treat soundtrack, stayed on the US charts for 11 months.
Wow.
I believe it sold a few million copies.
The pedigree's strong. Yeah, it's like, you know. Yeah.
It was the soundtrack did much better than the film, you know. And as I'm led to believe, anyway, you know.
Fast Eddie Clark. It's Fast Eddie Clark. Pete Way from UFO and Dave King from Flogging Molly. Like, it's like real credentials, real like rock royalty, you know. So, yeah, it's. I mean, so what was the three? What did you say so people could check them out?
Deathgasm,
Demons,
Nightmare Beach.
Stella?
Well, I had Deathgasm written down, but I also, not necessarily when it's a full soundtrack, but when you get a metal song just dropped in somewhere.
Unexpected.
And that's always really exciting, and that's really, you know, always makes me start yelling at my husband and he's not interested. So the one I wrote down that I always think about is the title sequence to Zombieland.
When it came to Metallica. Who never let their music on anything.
The music had only been on Paradise Lost.
South Park, I think, there's an unofficial Metallica thing. Yeah, but so, it's like it's never there, is
so
it?
So when I saw that in the cinema and the titles and that drops and I was like, yes, in the cinema.
That's me.
My husband was like, shut up. But it's Metallica, yeah, I can hear
just
that.
Just shout, Metallica!
And I've gone and watched back. I mean, I love the movie, but I've watched the titles, you know, just as a clip on YouTube over and over again, because I just love it so much.
That's a great soundtrack, dude. That's Everybody Wants Someone by Van Halen, I think. Yeah. That's a fucking great song.
Is Alison Chains on it as well?
Alison Chains. They're mic drops, yeah, think about that. I'm trying to think of my favourites now, so... We just tip me hat to Revenge of the Living Dead Part 2, but it's more punk. Peace, don't fight. And the Spawn soundtrack is particularly good. So what they do with horror soundtracks sometimes is they use it for an excuse to kind of like put mad things together, because fuck it, who cares? So you get Slayer with like EDM and stuff, and you get that. And what weirdly happens then is that those things people really fucking dig, and they become their own forms of music in their own right. So they're pretty good. Freddy vs. Jason, the soundtrack to that is a staple of 90s metal. That is in a CD at the end. For me, I've had to choose, it would be Demon Knight, if anybody's seen that, from the Tales from the Crypt series, the Demon Knight. That's fucking brilliant. That is that Cemetery Gates on there with Pantera. Angry Again, not Angry Again. The Rollins song as well. It should be on there, shouldn't it? There's a ton of great stuff on there. Hey Man, Nice Shot and Filter and stuff. That's a great CD, that is, like. But I like mic drops. I like what you say. Yeah, when it unexpected, because I knew it was going to be in there, but when it comes on and you're like, oh fuck, I'm into this. Yeah, that's what was the Fastest Shark and Demons. You know, you see it at the beginning, except, but then there's, you know. But then when it hits, it's fucking... I love that shit. Any questions? Anybody got... The man at the back there? Sorry, sir.
I have two, if you don't mind.
I cast as many as... What's your name, sir?
George.
Hey, George. How are we doing?
So, question one is about horror metal films, sort of. A big fan of Cradle of Filth. Has anyone watched Cradle of Fear?
I have. I'm aware of it. I had about four things that I wanted to watch because I knew someone would ask. I was hoping no one would ask that. And you did, so congratulations. Anybody seen it? Yep. Are you aware of it?
I'm aware of it.
Yeah. Terrible.
Didn't Danny do a thing where it was kind of a parody of the Blair Witch Project as well? Didn't he do something like that? I think it was just like fucking for shits and giggles. But there's no way that Cradle of Filth and Danny doesn't love the horror. There's no way Cradle of Filth don't exist if it isn't for horror. Because that's the other thing that we probably maybe need to say is that, like, yes, they had the zombie films of the 70s and we talk about them, but that's what we were all watching. So then when bands come out in 80s death metal and 90s death metal, they were using all that iconography, zombieification and stuff like that, and horror cannibalism and stuff. That was like the stock and trade there. So the two kind of like zombies fed off each other, you know?
Nice.
Nice, sweet. What was the second question, Jordan?
Ties in with what you're talking about in terms of gatekeeping, because today the new Devin Townsend album came out, Lightwork, and it's a bit too light for my liking.
You're not letting it in.
I actually had to turn it off 6 songs in because it just wasn't.
We're happy with it, yeah.
Am I being too much of a gatekeeper?
Isn't there as well, there was talk of the song Barbie Girl, it was a sample from that. But you know what, that's Devin Townsend, that is bang on for Devin Townsend, like, you know. But is it what, so... Well, is this the question that, you know, you didn't like it and you liked his whole body of work, or...?
Well, my favourite album of his is Transcendence.
Okay.
I just think it's got the right balance of heavy and melody. It's just pretty much heavy all the way through. And then you listen to this new one, and Empath is good as well. But this new one, I just thought, come on, guitars kick in, and they're just here and there, and I just ended up turning it off.
Do you follow him on social media, like on Twitter and stuff?
No.
Because he talks about this album, about how he kind of had to do this to kind of get to the next part of his life, and he's very much about chronicling the various elements of his creative process, very much on Front Street. And so with the, you know, he talks like he does a little, something of a podcast, and he talks about heavier than a really heavy thing and stuff, and how that's an exact approximation of his whole life up to then. So I would subscribe to you, sir, that he's probably, that is exactly what he's feeling right then, you know. But you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You don't go, right, I'm listening to Devin Townsend anymore. You wouldn't do that. And then somebody else, what's beautiful about that is that someone else will listen to that album and really love it and go, well, actually, that's the best thing that Devin Townsend's ever done. You're both right. You know, but at least that's he's opened just another door for someone else to come through there. So, you know, hopefully then, you know, he can play more shows and do that, and his mental health more than anything else will be because of that. But it's interesting, you know, you're not a fool. You understand that that's his shade of what he does. We're talking about people that would maybe damn them because of that, because of gatekeeping. Because that's gatekeeping within an artist. You know, it's not classic Maiden. It's not classic this. It's not like, it's like, fuck off, you know. Like, AC/DC come up a lot, don't they? Because they're like, they've produced the same record since it began. They haven't, just so you know. Go back and listen to Power Age, listen to Flick of the Switch, listen to For Those About to Rock, listen to The Razor's Edge. The Razor's Edge, the song itself, is almost experimental, I would put to you. It's just, we need to kind of open up that if you don't like that, you don't have to like everything that everybody does, you know.
Yeah,
I think that's it. Prog metal is, by definition, you're not going to like everything.
We like that, don't we, Sharky? Yeah. We like that prog metal likes that it's inaccessible. Yeah. It wallows in it, doesn't it?
As a retailer, prog metal, it's one of those things where I never stock specific album t-shirts. Because only 50% of the community is going to like.
Ladies and gentlemen, anybody that doesn't know, the wonderful Sharky, the owner of the Emporium, is probably in a really interesting place. Do you sell horror t-shirts?
No, it is something I've considered.
It seems like money on the table, yeah.
It's just a question of space and budget at the moment.
So there isn't a table?
If I can win the lottery, I will do it.
Yeah. But you get people asking them, that's what I'm saying. So, and when someone comes to your shop and they've gone, okay, I listened to this particular album, stuff like that, do you see people getting into the genre?
Oh, yeah. And
okay.
Some Stranger Things especially, I'm getting 12, 13-year-old kids.
Interesting.
Just discovered Metallica, and they're like, yeah. Oh, I've got Master of Puppets. What album do I need to listen to next?
Oh,
like, right.
I see.
Rise of the Lamb. Stay away from
Satan. So you suggest Lulu? What did you say?
No. Right. Stay away from Lulu. There was another one that kind of got overshadowed by Stranger Things on Netflix. There was another one called Lord of Metal.
She was the bass player, was it? That was a mic drop there, or a needle drop, I should say. Because the girl is out of it for spoilers. Is out of it for a couple of episodes, and then she comes back fully metallized. And it's to I think it's five minutes alone.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's five minutes alone. And when that came in, I was like, that's me. Pointing at the screen. That's me. So yeah, I love that life.
There was another point I was gonna make. I think another thing that links horror and metal is how accessible they are for creative people.
That's interesting.
Like Sabbath made two albums in 1970, two amazing albums for like 500 quid each. Mm. And like, look at all the big directors.
Oh, you! I see what you're saying. Yeah, you mean like from an accessibility point of view, you could right.
And like all the big film directors now, Cameron, Peter Jackson, you know, Ridley Scott, even Spielberg with Duel, you could say all started low budget horror movies because you could get a lot of production value very cheaply.
Yeah.
And if you watch the, I don't know if anyone's seen the film Super 8.
Yes.
It's not really a horror film, but the kids in Super 8, they get the first Super 8 camera. What do? They make a zombie movie because they can do it really cheaply and it looks great.
I didn't think about that from an accessibility point of view,
metal, I think, because you can buy a guitar quite cheaply, and you know, in the 80s when cassette recorders first became a thing, you could actually record something onto a tape and you could pass it around.
I never considered the accessibility factor, because like some of the best underground films of all time, like you look at the Blair Witch Project, it makes like $300 million and it's made for fuck all, you know, and it's like most of the best metal albums, like we talk Sabbath's first album, made in like eight hours. Yeah, I never considered that. Yeah,
looking at Sabbath, say they made an album for 500 quid. Now they've got their own private jet. We can get into it.
But the horror genre because it has creativity, because it doesn't have a horror film or a horror TV show or a horror comic or whatever. It doesn't have a place where it needs to end up. If you're watching a rom com, and you know, don't. you know from the start, there's these two people on the poster, you know they're going to end up together at the end of the film. When you go and watch a horror film or a TV show or whatever, you don't know where you're going to end up, so that allows for that expansion of creativity, even if you've just got, you know, like you say, 50 quid.
Yeah, and it's great. And even now, you know, you can get a guitar and you can get sort of, I'm not a tech person, but you can get like stuff like Pro Tools and make a whole metal album very cheaply now.
Yeah,
and get it out there.
In your bedroom.
Exactly.
Question at the back, say, what was your name, sorry?
Harrison.
Hey, Harrison, how are you doing?
I'm curious if you've ever got into a band because of the film, because I can think of several.
Oh, that's a great question. What's the panel if it got into a band because of a film?
I was a big, like, VHS book, you know, years ago. Still am, really.
Have you got a wall of them?
Yeah, I used to go once in the
Love it.
Because I remember the video shop days, you know, and I was I would say that there are several films that really got me into certain bands. Demons really got me into it, Sam.
Yeah.
And Return of the Living Dead Part 2.
Part 2, yeah.
That really got me into it.
Some great punk songs on there.
And so I then would go out and find these records, so I would then go hunt down LPs. I would wait for the credits. And then I would go and hunt the album, so any films that really got me.
Well, I mentioned before, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors.
Yeah,
so I think that kind of did get me kind of into Dokken, the band. You know, that was my kind of favourite Dokken song, and that was the only song I knew off that album, Back for the Attack, which was out in 87 as well, same year as Nightmare on Elm Street 3. What tarnished my memory of Dream Warriors, though, recently I listened to an interview with George Lynch, the guitarist with Dokken, and he was telling me that on the video shoot for Dream Warriors, Robert Englund, the guy who played Freddy Krueger, had them all snorting cocaine off the Freddy Krueger glove.
That is the most metal thing that anybody could ever do.
I was just like, oh my God, you know. So that kind of freaked me out a bit. So that kind of changed my perception of
that. Video out.
They were
all fucking...
Yeah, they were really high
on beak
during that video. So that scene where Robert Englund grabs George Lynch...
I have completely re-evaluated George Lynch and Dokken, like.
In fact, George Lynch was so high, he couldn't hardly stand up. So that scene where they grab him, drag him through the wall, that he's high as a kite because they'd been just taking drugs all day.
Once again, it's probably not metal, but it's probably not horror For me, it was Last Action Hero. And that's like, that blindsided, the movie itself blindsided me for various reasons, but the soundtrack, because this was kind of pre-internet, so you really couldn't have, you had to kind of like go to record stores and stuff. But I remember like the opening thing is like, it has this big explosion or whatever, and then it's Angry Again by Megadeth, and I was like, whoa, hold on, so it's all metal. But then no, it would be like Fishbone. I discovered Fishbone, never even heard of Fishbone. And Swim was the song on that. And that's like a whole genre of stuff. They've been going a long time. That album's like, that's superb. That is, and it's...
on that song.
What's that song?
AC/DC's on that song.
A Big Gun. And there's all those big names, but there's like I say, Fishbone kind of buried in there. You know, Aerosmith are on this stuff, but there's like, you know, Angry Again, which is one of, you know, Alice in Chains' best songs, like, you know, certainly one of Jerry Cantzel's, What the Hell Have I, Angry Again's the Megadeth one. Angry Again's a superb Megadeth song, but What the Hell Have I, check that song out. That's classic Cantrell playing that, and I remember what that was. Christ, I have to go back and check some of these. It was the first time I'd heard someone, like I say, Fishbone, and I went back and found a whole raft of stuff, and then the internet kind of maybe stopped that type of thing. I don't know, can it happen again? Probably, where you watch a film and surprised by the music. Well, yeah,
I'm sure. Yeah, I think so.
Any particular movies for you?
Not as detailed as always.
Sorry.
We've got time for one quick question.
There you go. Man at the back.
See, I must be not quite horror, but I know on something like your fans that you got into because of a film.
Rage Against the Machines on there, Marilyn Manson's on there.
Ramstein I actually got into from the film Triple X with Vin Diesel.
Really?
Except for Zorky, obviously.
Yeah, that's a great soundtrack, that, like, yeah. What I'm trying to think of the song,
isn't
it?
I've got a sister who's getting up for a decade younger than me, and on the subject of Mr. Tablet, I remember his previous band, Scrappin' Young Lad, and they had this song, Love. I remember Badger and JJ, to put it in the crazy house, he kept telling me to fuck off. I don't know if anyone remembers the video for that, but basically it's a takeoff of the Evil Dead. I remember saying it, and I was, for the first time, because I didn't have a TV, I still haven't got a TV, and I got to meet my dad for Christmas, and I'm watching Skulls, and that was a thing, and it came on, and I was like, oh, fuck, yeah, and I was cursing myself, laughing, and my sister was like, so funny, and I was like, I need to show you something, and so it's like, you know, it's the opposite of gatekeeping.
Mm-hmm. We did cover that. That's something we didn't really get into as well. We did a little bit with the Dream. What do you think? Like videos that metal bands started to do got like, you know, very graphic.
Yes.
You know, you think of the stuff that Gwar was doing, you know, and then, you know, stuff that Trent was doing with Nine Inch Nails. Mm-hmm. These were all kind of like easily influenced by experimental horror. Easily, mm-hmm. You know, a lot of Nine Inch Nails stuff. We never really covered that. That's probably for another day. We didn't cover like, you know, God, so much we didn't cover. Like, I like bands like Ice Nine Kills and stuff and things like that. That are like fully on their sleeve. Like, this is what we like. You know, this is the. Maybe we should do some more of these. Will we do, if we screen some more films and had some more chats, would that be something people would enjoy? Yeah, there you go. That works, doesn't it? Look.
If you can get hold of that, there's going to be a
big person that fights me that we don't do demons. There's absolutely that has to happen.
The actual film, Heavy Metal.
Sorry
to disturb you guys.
Right.
Is this ticket only? Is this?
It's meant to be ticket only, but if someone's turned up,
we won't gatekeep them out.
You know, we're on the desk and, you know, we're a card only, so we need to know what.
Yeah, it was.
What do you know a lot of people in the box?
Depends. Have they got booze?
No, I didn't.
just pause. When you were saying before about it's actually important when a metal song appears on the soundtrack of a non-metal film,
yeah.
I literally got into Twisted Sister because one of their songs was on a teen comedy in the 90s called Road Trip.
Yeah.
I don't know if anyone remembers.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
but there's a scene with Twisted Sister on the soundtrack. I was like, what's that?
This is a bit silly, but...
Yeah, cool.
There was a cover of I Want to Rock by Twisted Sister on the SpongeBob film in 2004.
Dead right there was.
It turns up everywhere, doesn't it?
They asked Dee Snider how the hell did that happen, and he said, look, I've got two kids going to college, they paid me $300,000 for that.
Yeah.
So that's how I ended up.
The elephant in the room is that how metal has Ned just been essentially took away by the police. and left it. How fucking cool. The show was closed down. It was deemed too. Yeah, it was deemed too offensive. And they've shut us down like any good horror film or any good metal show.
I love that. Have you ever seen the video for Be Cruel to Your School? It's the one that Twisted Sister and Alice Cooper did together.
That sounds amazing.
It's a proper zombie thing. I think it's Savini doing the zombie makeup.
Oh shit.
And it got banned by MTV. Yay. It's the most cheesiest fucking thing ever. And it got banned by MTV because it was too graphic.
So now where police have released him from custody, we can get on with it. Ned, do you want to introduce the film when we sit? I'm going to go amongst everybody and watch it.
Cherry Calls is a short-lived phenomenon. I don't think heavy metal horror films are as short-lived as what he makes out. I think they stretch into the 90s and even beyond, you know, with the likes of Deathgasm. But certainly the heavy metal horror film kind of gets seen as a sort of subgenre in its own right in the mid-1980s. And there are reasons for this. And the reason is the moral panic around heavy metal. So not only did American heavy metal become a dominant genre of American music, according to Robert Walzer, it also became a site of social contestation. Lots of people debating, is metal good for our youth, and so on. And as we talked about in the podcast, panel discussion, I should say, we talked about the Parents Music Resource Centre, this powerful pressure group, who were alleging lots of things. They were alleging that metal caused people to be violent, to be suicidal, to get involved in Satanism, and so on. That moral panic, as we saw in the panel discussion, had an impact on young people's lives. Now, these heavy metal horror films have some things in common. So whether you're watching Black Roses, whether you're watching Rock and Roll Nightmare, whether you're watching Trick or Treat, or The Gate, there are teen characters who are struggling with a dysfunctional family life. The loss of a parent, pressures of high school, and so on. We get lots of iconography from metal music culture, music, albums, fashion, battle jackets, denim, leather, long hair, etc. And we get the idea that metal can be a potential source of salvation. But alongside that, we get the idea that metal can also get one into trouble, that metal's a kind of corrupting influence. So a lot of these films play on this idea that metal is corrupting. And you could argue they sort of send it up, they satirise it a little bit. Another thing that I think distinguishes heavy metal horror films, and this is something that I've written about a little bit more in depth, is the idea that domestic music technologies like stereo systems become conduits for evil. If anyone has seen the film Black Roses, terrible movie by the late John Fasano, there's probably the most spectacular scene of all in that movie is when the father of one of the kids gets swallowed by the stereo system and he's eaten by a speaker monster. So that's the only scene you need to watch in that film. It's fantastic. Trick or Treat, which we're going to see in a second, had a mixed critical reception. Some people saw it kind of as being a kind of satire. I think we can certainly see it that way. It sends up the idea that rock music tells kids to do bad things and kids do them. Some people criticised the film and said it's not scary enough. Certainly it isn't very scary. I think Kim Newman once called it about as scary as an episode of Scooby-Doo. It's not very scary, folks. But I think, as I've said, what we need to understand it in as a product of its time. It was, the intention was satire. That was made clear in the production notes of the film. Fans have known that, you know, people who've responded to this film on IMDb. But also, I think there's a serious side to this film. And the serious side to this film is that some kids, some fans who engage with this movie, both at the time and later, can identify with the central character who is bullied. So that there is some interesting elements to this. So without further ado, let's now delve into the world of...
I love that you've actually cited an IMDb commenter.
Of course.
JC Button.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Well, you've got to. You've got to. Okay, so are we ready? Oh.
So there you go, that was a nice little Halloween treat for you. I hope you enjoyed the previous episode, the Halloween special with Eric Vaughan. That was getting that already. People are sending some really nice messages about that, so it's fantastic to hear that. And I hope you enjoyed this one. Is this something we should do more often? Should we do these Q&As and screening of films and stuff? Should we do that more often? I think so. I think that's something I really enjoy. Speaking of which, the live show, the Spoken Metal Show live on the 9th of November at the Outpost, is going to be, this is looking like a whole load of fun. Christopher Brown, UK music solicitor, those music guys, all as guests with a live Q&A as well. It's going to be a lot of fun. That's Thursday, the 9th of November at the Outpost. Tickets are free, but you must register now. As always, thanks for listening, and I'll see you at the show.